Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, the trouble with trash. COVID-19 has made this a miserable summer for Philadelphia's sanitation workers and residents. We'll get the latest from Streets Commissioner Carlton Williams on efforts to clear piles of garbage. Also, Opera Philadelphia is hoping to skirt the pandemic and hit a high note by going online this fall. We'll hear from General Director David Devan and tenor and artistic advisor Lawrence Brownlee, and we'll be taking your call and comments throughout the hour at 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. But to begin, we bring you up to speed on the coronavirus and its ongoing presence in Philadelphia and across Pennsylvania. There has been some positive news in the city. The daily number of new coronavirus cases fell by 25% over the course of a week recently. We'll talk about what this could mean and whether a continuing downward trend might prompt the city to move toward a full reopening. We'll also look at the numbers statewide and learn about a group of coronavirus survivors whose symptoms do not seem to subside. They are called long haulers. WHYY's Nina Feldman has been covering all this, and she joins us once again on the Roundup. Hello, Nina.
Hi, Mary.
Well, it's always nice to report some encouraging news. So let's start with a fairly significant drop, Nina, recently in the daily number of new COVID cases in Philadelphia. Tell us more.
Last week, Health Commissioner Tom Farley announced that the two-week average of new daily cases had dropped from about 160 the week prior to closer to 110. And when he made this announcement, he seemed pretty pleasantly surprised, I would say. It seemed like, you know, while the city hoped that its measures that it was putting into place for social distancing and mask wearing were going to improve the number of new transmissions, it seemed like that was working slightly more dramatically and quickly than he had expected. So he was pleased to announce that change, and it looks so far like those declines have been able to hold. So it doesn't seem to be an aberration. It seems like where our numbers are really going down in Philadelphia.
Okay, but regardless, he says it is not time to let our guard down, right?
That's right. So I think it's important to remember that asymptomatic spread is still a very real possibility. Farley gave the example of a recent incident at one of the Philadelphia Department of Prisons where somebody in prison went to the hospital for an unrelated medical reason. And right now, anybody being admitted to any hospital in the city is being tested for the coronavirus, regardless of what they're there for. And the person happened to test positive even though they didn't have any symptoms. So then you have to go back to their unit and test everybody else there. And they found, you know, lo and behold, a handful of other people tested positive as well. So, you know, those just offer helpful examples of how asymptomatic spread can sort of unknowingly function.
Yeah. And there's a real sobering side to the recovery piece of this. You just reported this morning, Nina, on a group of COVID patients who I believe are dubbed long haulers. It just takes a while, if it seems ever, that the virus clears the system. Tell us more about that.
A lot of these patients are actually pretty young and otherwise healthy, and their COVID symptoms when they were sick weren't that dramatic. They weren't that severe. Most of them didn't require hospitalization at the peak of their illness. And what they found is just after, you know, the 2 or even 3 week mark, when it seems like symptoms are normally expected to subside, sometimes their symptoms that they had initially continue to persist, and other times it's kind of a new slate of symptoms. So it's less of the acute, you know, fever and chills and body aches, and it's more often you hear about extreme fatigue, you know, alarming fatigue, you know, a sore throat, swollen glands, headaches, shortness of breath that never existed before to the extent where people can't walk up a flight of stairs. And again, these are oftentimes otherwise completely healthy people without underlying conditions that are just feeling these long-term effects for weeks or months beyond their initial illness. And doctors just don't really know what to do about it yet.
So there is no comprehensive treatment for these people.
No, they're watching and they're waiting, and they're able to, you know, offer some relief for some symptoms. Some people have been prescribed inhalers. Others are, you know, offered antihistamine to try to reduce inflammation. And sometimes those sort of piecemeal solutions can work, but it's really just a day-by-day, person-by-person evaluation. And I think for a lot of people, there is not a whole lot of relief with the options that are available right now. So it's a pretty dire outlook for a lot of the folks that I talk to.
Yeah, and some of them felt they weren't being heard by their doctors when they complained of these long-term symptoms.
Right. I think there is so much that we're still learning about this novel coronavirus. That's this whole thing, is that it's new. And, you know, primary care doctors only know as much as the research reveals.
Sure.
And some might be a little bit uncomfortable, you know, prescribing or offering advice for something that might not be totally borne out in the science. So you have these new specialized clinics that are starting to pop up to at least be able to offer patients who are experiencing these symptoms a place to go where somebody will listen to them, pay attention to them, and then as the research emerges, you know, be able to offer them the latest treatment when it becomes available.
Back to testing. Last week, Tropical Storm Isaias wreaked havoc, of course, in Philly and the surrounding area. Has this hampered recent testing efforts?
Philadelphia's testing effort or testing numbers are still being, the city is still reporting the numbers that they were reporting before. So Philadelphia has, you know, more than 2,000 tests a day, and that's pretty good. And, you know, those numbers statewide are also expanding. The city is expanding their testing efforts in rural counties as well. So I think even if there was a little bit of a blip for, you know, due to the rain, what we've seen is that the overall testing infrastructure has expanded and grown and solidified. So it ends up offering, you know, a bit of a safety net for those instances where folks can't get out to get tested or maybe can't stand out to do the testing in the event of severe weather.
Nina, Philadelphia remains in a modified green phase of reopening, meaning certain businesses are still restricted. Any word as to when indoor dining at restaurants or going to the theater or large indoor social gatherings might resume?
A lot of people have been asking that, and the health commissioner in Philadelphia seems to be taking a pretty conservative approach to it, which I think is understandable. You know, he notes that the evidence really points to the fact that people being in indoor spaces with masks off is what leads to increased transmission. And when you're eating or drinking inside at a bar or a restaurant, that's, you know, you have to have a mask off. And so it's sort of like, this is kind of the final frontier of businesses that are going to stay closed because it's the most susceptible to the virus is spreading. So we haven't heard anything about a date or, you know, a possible reopening time for that. Originally, they were considering August 1st. Obviously, we're past that. It's not happening then. So I think we're going to have to see consistent lower numbers for that conversation to get started again, which, you know, as we talked about earlier, we're on the way to. So who knows how soon that conversation will get kicked off, but nothing so far.
Okay. Speaking of mask wearing, do officials have a sense of what compliance looks like across the state?
Right. So there have been some complaints from business owners across the state who say, hey, you know, we want people in our stores to wear masks, but these are new guidances and rules, and there aren't explicit, you know, penalties for people who don't wear masks. We want help from the state for that. And, you know, Governor Wolf has made it clear that his approach for mask enforcement and mask wearing is going to be one more focused on education than on enforcement. I think he wants people to really understand that wearing a mask protects other people, which is why everybody has to do it. And the more those public health messages get out to the broader residents of the Commonwealth, the more he assumes that compliance will ensue. So I think that's true to a certain degree, but as we've seen, there are people who don't want to wear masks, and at that point, you know, it ends up being between those business owners and those shoppers or those consumers. So that ends up being a little bit more of a friction point.
Nina, not sure you have these numbers at your fingertips, but do we have the latest word on how many coronavirus deaths there have been across the state of Pennsylvania?
Yes. So as of Friday, there were 117,000, just over 117,000 cases statewide, and just over 7,000 deaths.
Okay.
So that's a grim number, too. You know, people, sure. The deaths are going down, but but we still have people dying from this virus across the state every day.
And how about deaths in Philadelphia alone?
In Philadelphia, we have about 1,700 deaths. So, and deaths are slowing here as well. You know, we have days where nobody dies in Philadelphia, which it's been a long time since that was the case. You know, dating back to the start of the pandemic. So that's those days are good days. But you know, it is still a sort of steady trickle of fatalities, unfortunately.
Nina Feldman, is contact tracing proving to be of real benefit in determining community spread in Philadelphia?
The contact tracing operation run by the city is definitely building up its workforce. So there are over 100 people working for the city doing contact tracing now, which is pretty good given the number of new cases we have each day. I think what they've reported out is that the real challenge is getting residents and contacts to participate. So you got to have somebody answer their phone when you call. And, you know, we're all used to spam and robocalls and, you know, hanging up or not answering if it's a number we don't know. And so the city's really trying to encourage people to answer their phone and have that conversation and share their contacts and share the phone numbers of people who they might have had contact with to be able to facilitate this process and make it smoother so that, you know, those contact tracers can call those contacts and let them know, hey, you've been exposed. You have to stay home and isolate.
Now, that's an important point. Thanks, Nina, for that. One more quick question before we let you go. Higher ed has been hit particularly hard by the pandemic. There is some welcome news for colleges and universities in Pennsylvania, some much-needed aid from the state. We've got about 15 seconds or so.
That's right. So the funding is being determined by population, student population, and the number of socioeconomically disadvantaged students in higher ed, and it's all going to go towards improving safety precautions on campus, which a lot of students are coming back to campus. So that is going to help, I think, for those universities across the Commonwealth.
All right, Nina Feldman, as always, a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nina Feldman is a health reporter for WHYY. Up next, it is Philadelphia's Streets Commissioner, Carlton Williams, talks about efforts to clear the streets of mounds of trash during the pandemic. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The spring and summer of 2020 have been extraordinarily difficult for Philadelphia's sanitation workers and city residents and businesses, besieged by growing mounds of smelly and often downright revolting trash. Philadelphia's sanitation department is grappling with a significant staffing shortage as employees working long hours and longer weeks fall ill with the virus. There are also complaints that personal protective gear is insufficient. And Tropical Storm Isaias piled on last week, hammering Philadelphia for hours, leading to flooding in neighborhoods like Eastwick and Manayunk, and, of course, fresh mounds of sodden carpeting, furniture, and more heading to the curb. All this as the sanitation department contends with a COVID-related cut of over $2 million to the budget. So how does the streets department get ahead of the mess and press forward? If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 888-477-9499. Send us an email to radiotimes at whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Streets Department Commissioner Carlton Williams is with us once again for the regional roundup. Welcome back, Carlton.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on again.
So how would you characterize the last few months and its effect on your department?
It's been very challenging. The pandemic has felt unprecedented challenges for the department in terms of increased tonnage and also attendance issues. And so when you have the combination of more tonnage and less people, you have start to get significant delays, is what we've been experiencing over the last couple of months. But most recently in July, it's really picked up with the torrential storms that we've had so far this summer season. So all of those make matters very complicated for us to get trash and recycling on a normal collection schedule. We are working tremendously hard, as you stated in your opening. We've been working pretty much every day since the pandemic has begun to deal with the additional tonnage. And this is not unique to the city of Philadelphia. The industry reports nationwide that trash tonnage is up 30%. And if you parallel that to the commercial industry, where restaurants and other businesses get private collection, their trash is down 30%. So people staying at home is definitely having a big effect on the amount of waste that's being produced on municipal curbside systems like here in the city of Philadelphia. What we're doing to address it, the mayor immediately ordered the hiring of 120 additional workers mm-hmm. to help get trash back on a normal collection schedule. We are hiring at present. It takes a while to bring in that many people.
Okay.
And so in the next couple of weeks, we should have the additional staff necessary to bring them in. In the meantime, what we're doing is, of course, adjusting our operations to catch up on backlogs. For instance, this week, we've delayed trash and recycling for this upcoming week one day so we can get previous week's complaints. We had a lot of recycling on the ground, and that was basically our focus on mitigating the health, to focus all of our resources to get the trash up.
So
as
for
you stated in your
But no, I was just going to say, so for people who have been waiting, who've had piles of trash at the curb for a long time, when can they reasonably expect relief, Carlton Williams?
Well, the trash is close to on schedule now. That's
okay.
One of the things that I was mentioning. What we did over the last couple of weeks to mitigate the immediate effects of the health and public safety issues related to trash is we dedicated all of our resources to picking up trash to get them back on schedule. What suffered when we did that is that recycling now is delayed tremendously. So now we're focusing on getting recycling back on a regular schedule, because that has been delayed for a week or more and throughout the city of Philadelphia and different parts of the city. So that's what actually we're in the process right now. But trash, we're happy to say, is close to on schedule or day behind like we've ordered it this week.
Okay. At last word, about 10% of the workforce was out, many testing positive for the virus or in close proximity to someone who has COVID. WHYY's Catalina Jaramillo spoke with Omar Salam of the Sanitation Workers Union, who says he calls the problem mismanagement, that the union has been asking for PPE even before the pandemic hit, and that what workers have now is inadequate. What is your response to Salam's charge?
Well, we certainly don't agree with the fact that it's mismanagement. I don't think no municipality in the country was prepared for what the pandemic had to present to the city of Philadelphia in terms of additional tonnage. And if you do your research, you'll see that other cities at Baltimore, Atlanta, even Toledo, Tacoma, Washington, all the way up and down the East and West Coast, everyone is dealing with these challenges. So we disagree with that. And also, the numbers that have been presented seem to be a bit exaggerated in terms of 10%. But nevertheless, there are employees that are impacted by COVID that we're assisting with. Now, when it comes down to PPE, the department has done all it can to bring in, to get the necessary equipment for employees to be protected and safe. We've purchased thousands of masks, gloves, face shields, protective equipment. They're already issued prick-proof gloves. So many of the things that the union is contending is already in place, and the department has been distributing them. We wanted to make sure that they have them, so now they sign for all of their items so that there's no disagreement between who has them and who doesn't. And we want to make sure that they're wearing them, because not only as it impacts themselves, it can impact others who may come in contact with
should
them.
They so have,
we're
should,
working extremely hard to get it done.
Sorry to interrupt. Should they have N95 masks, and are they available to your sanitation workers?
So N95 masks, just like any other industry, is kind of challenging to come by, because you're actually competing with other essential workers like the healthcare workers and police and fire and everyone else that's out in the field. So it's a supply and demand issue when it comes down to N95 masks. We originally was getting them in the beginning. It's very difficult to get them now, but we're still trying to purchase them and getting them out to our employees. But we believe that the face shields we offer are just as effective, and the masks that we're currently giving them is effective as well.
So are you comfortable then that your workers are safe as reasonably possible heading out for what is probably a long day doing their job?
Given the current situation, I believe so. There are still potential risks of exposure. We do contact tracing. If an employee is found to be positive and comes to work, they don't necessarily have to have it at work. They can get it from home and then come to work. And when we discover anyone that comes in contact with them, we immediately quarantine them to stop the spread throughout the department. So I think we're doing what's reasonably possible to keep our employees safe on a very difficult job. And we understand the challenges that they face, and their health and safety is our number one priority.
Do they receive hazard pay? And if not, should they receive hazard pay? Hazard pay.
So hazard pay has been a point of contention from the union for quite some time, most recently during this pandemic. We certainly took a look at it in the beginning when we were paying employees time and a half for essential workforce. Obviously, the city's budget couldn't support that. So we looked at different ways to try to get them compensated. And the solution was to actually give them a contract that included a $750 bonus and a 2% raise. I mean, most other cities and most other employees who are not unionized representatives did not get that. Our employees did. So the administration worked it out with the union to get them that raise. Hazardous pay, for whatever reason, was not in that agreement. And so given the budgetary challenges that we face in the city of Philadelphia, that's going to be a challenge for us to issue.
All right. We are speaking with Carlton Williams, Commissioner of the Philadelphia Streets Department, and we've got some comments coming in, so let's get to them. EM says, I think it's up to the administration, Streets Department, to be able to track what street has been done and what's going to be done next. In this way, we, especially in the side streets, can plan appropriately. Just a simple website or bulletin in text updated daily. What do you think, Carlton?
So that's a great question, and we are working on a response. We have a website and a platform that we actually started before the pandemic called Street Smart PHL, which you can log on to and see an update on real-time services for the city of Philadelphia. We were about to launch Pickup PHL, but it was sidetracked through the pandemic. We then revisited, and we're about to launch it now so that you can actually see exactly where pickups are occurring throughout the city of Philadelphia and messaging to say where we are. Prior to this release, however, that's very difficult when you don't know what your staffing levels are going to be on a daily basis. Some days you may have enough crews to pick up trash to get it up on time throughout the day. Other days you may not. And so that's very difficult to message to residents. So we give them a general idea of where we are a day behind, 2 days behind. But specifically to do it by a block was very challenging. But now we think we have the technology for residents to be able to log on. And in the next couple of weeks, we plan to launch it so residents can click on and see exactly where our trucks are and our recycling is and messaging to go along with that.
Okay. Comment from Paul in Philadelphia. Why doesn't PPA, the Philadelphia Parking Authority, contribute money toward trash collection since it does involve the streets as well? Thoughts?
So PPA already gives a significant portion to the Philadelphia School District, which offsets some of the general fund budget that supports sanitation. I think asking them for more at this point in time will be a stretch, given all of the challenges that we face with the city's budget gap. We have a $629 million budget gap that is increasing as the longer this pandemic goes along and less revenues are being brought in from businesses. So there's some challenges. I don't think PPA's contribution alone will not only help the city's problem, it will certainly help a lot of areas in the city of Philadelphia, not specifically sanitation. But we have to balance competing priorities with the amount of monies that's coming in from different revenue sources.
Right. Our listener, Deborah, is weighing in. She says, the city needs to require or provide large trash cans for every building and residence and charge for them in a water or other bill. No more paper bags of garbage, open boxes, and plastic bags. And Carlton Williams, if it sounds doable, it'll certainly make life for sanitation workers a lot easier.
Absolutely. I think what you're seeing in other areas, why they're not reporting many problems, is that they do have those strict policies on bins and what you can put in and outside of the bin, and you pay as you throw is the concept, where people actually have a subscription service for trash. We're general funded in the city of Philadelphia, and in situations like this, it makes it very challenging when you have very liberal trash regulations, where people can put out 8 bags and 4 containers, and during this pandemic, they've been exceeding those much more. If we had a distribution system where it was bin only, it certainly would manage the amount of waste. But that would did put the onus on the residents to figure out what they would actually do with it. Would they take it to one of our drop-off centers? Would they illegally dump it? So those are the challenges that we face in the city of Philadelphia when we talk about a bin program. It's certainly to do. You just have to have the infrastructure and the setup in place to be able to get that done. But that's something, that's an option that we should consider for the future, and it's a great suggestion.
Okay, one more comment. Barry in Philadelphia references recycling. He says recycling hasn't been picked up for weeks and has been sitting on the sidewalks and blowing around and covering the streets. Is there a plan to clean this up once the recycling has been picked up?
So we, as you know, the mayor had a plan to expand mechanical street sweeping citywide, which was about to launch actually this fiscal year. Unfortunately, the pandemic minimized our resources and we had to cut that portion of the program. We do have mechanical brooms still out on commercial corridors. If there's areas that were significantly impacted by recycling blown over from last week's hurricane, we certainly will try to send sweepers out to get those areas cleaned up. And they should report those areas to 311 or contact our department so we can address it.
All right. Carlton Williams, Commissioner of the Philadelphia Streets Department, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Okay. And we now turn our attention to Opera Philadelphia. That's Opera Philadelphia tenor Lawrence Brownlee singing from Cycles of My Being, part of the upcoming Opera Philadelphia season. For the rest of the hour, we're going to look at how Opera Philadelphia is reshaping the upcoming season with an eye toward the safety of its patrons, performers, and staff during the pandemic. A new Opera Philadelphia channel will offer opera reimagined for streaming devices and the TV screen, performance for film as opposed to the stage. Joining us now to tell us more is Opera Philadelphia President and General Director David Devan. Welcome.
It's lovely to be with you.
And Lawrence Brownlee is Artistic Advisor and Tenor. Pleasure to have you with us, Lawrence.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you today.
So let's go first to David. Of course, what a year it's been. Tell us about the effect the pandemic has had on Opera Philadelphia and the decision-making that went into the pivot from live to filmed performance.
Sure. The pandemic has had an immeasurable effect. You know, opera requires a lot of people singing and therefore expressing lots of droplets in close proximity for some duration of time. So in the spring, we had to move our Madama Butterfly production to a future season. And looking forward to the upcoming season and not being able to safely put artists together for the scale of our work as it would ordinarily happen, got us to rethinking how we could remain a artistic presence in our community, and it turns out our country, by having a dialogue with those artists, such as Larry, who's on the line with us. And also we learned from research that the vast majority of our audience does not feel comfortable walking into a theater pre-vaccine. And so all that led us to the Opera Philadelphia channel, which would be largely our virtual season. We'll hopefully be able to reconvene for Tosca in the spring. But that's the genesis of the idea. I can go in more, but that's my first answer.
Okay, well, we'll get into the nuts and bolts of the production of the film performances in just a bit. But Lawrence Brownlee, how has the pandemic affected you as a performer? I imagine as a singer, you have to be especially careful not to contract contract this virus.
Well, absolutely. You know, as a performer, I miss it a great deal. And, you know, not being able to be on the stage is one of the things I really love. I'm an artist, so I like to create art. And so I'm anxious to get back. But I'm with David and everyone else. I think we need to keep people safe. We need to keep people, of course, we need to keep people in mind. And a lot of times you think opera audiences sometimes are some of the older generation. And so we need to make sure that we look out for all of those people. As a performer, I'm ready to get back. But I'm in solidarity with all of my colleagues to make sure that we keep everyone safe until we can get back to the theater.
How are you keeping your voice in shape during this rather unusual time?
I'm practicing at home, and I'm doing some things virtually, just trying to stay, you know, up. You know, I think the vaccine probably is a little ways away, and so I'm not going to be running and to do any live performances, but I am doing a few scheduled recorded performances. So I am staying in practice, not quite as much as normal, but I'm trying to keep my chops pretty much together as much as I can.
Okay, we're speaking with Lawrence Brownlee, tenor with Opera Philadelphia, also David Devan, general director and president of Opera Philadelphia. And after the break, we're going to talk some more about how Opera Philadelphia is shifting in light of the pandemic for the upcoming season. You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. Do stay with us for that. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we are in conversation with Lawrence Brownlee, a tenor and artistic advisor with Opera Philadelphia, also David Devan, general director and president of Opera Philadelphia, and we are talking about the company's plans for the upcoming season in light of the pandemic. There is a shift to something called the Opera Philadelphia Channel, and David, let's talk a little bit about that shift in production. When moving Opera Philadelphia from the stage to film, we're not talking about the straight transfer of a major theatrical production to a film stage, right?
Correct. It's sort of like if we were to give HBO the keys to an opera company, what would they do? And we're taking that attitude that what we're going to be doing is developing performances that are COVID safe with the appropriate amount of people and distancing. And we're going to tape it like it and produce it like it were for TV with editing. And it will be on a channel channel that people can subscribe to for the season for $99. And it's available on all your major screens, your through Chromecast, Apple TV, Android TV, Amazon Fire, et cetera. So the big change for us is working with no audience and basically film people versus sort of live directing people. but the idea is that we don't want people to be reminded what they're missing by looking at something that goes direct from stage into TV. We want someone to have satisfying artistic experience, both the artist and the audience. And if they're finished watching this, that they're like, wow, was I ever happy that that touched my life?
Well, let's talk about the visuals a bit. You referenced keeping people safe, and I'm assuming you know the 6 feet apart. How does this translate when you're taking a typical production in opera, in which you know people are close together? They are also not only singing, of course, but they're acting as well. How does this translate to the film? How do you shift the technique in making the story work that way?
The first thing you do is shift scale. So first of all, opera singers, the distance is way more than 6 feet
okay.
Because, you know, they really, they really express themselves vocally. Most of our shows will have 1 to 2 singers. So we don't have the distant problem. And in Larry's first show, Lawrence Brownlee and Friends, there will be multiple, but they will be distance, quite some distance away. And you do film editing techniques to bring them closer.
Got it.
We'll also be using sound stages instead of traditional stages, which allow us to be distanced, but through editing and a whole bunch of cameras, it won't feel like that.
Okay. And by the way, too, I should give the number out. It's 888-477-9499. If our listeners would like to jump into the conversation or send us an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. So again, the first production will be an archival stage performance of La Traviata. But then in November, it's an original film production called Cycles of My Being. Lawrence, you are co-creator. Tell us about this work.
Cycles of My Being came to be a few years ago when I woke up one day and I just seemed to be really bothered by what I had been seeing on TV as an African-American man in this society, of course, living with the knowledge that I live a different reality than someone who has blonde hair and blue eyes. And so, you know, we see the media, you know, we're giving information all the time. And so about what black men and black people in this society go through. So I wanted to use my cachet and my artistic, I guess, license or what I had built up to be able to speak on what it means to be a black man in America. And so myself, along with a gentleman, a wonderful composer by the name of Tyshawn Sorey, who's a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner, and Terrence Hayes, who's also lyricist, poet. He's also a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner. We all came together with our collective experiences to be able to talk about the realities of being a black man in the United States. And so we talk about hope, we talk about love, we talk about pain and hate. And so this is the opportunity for us to take control of the discussion and be able to express what our lives are like so people can see what it means or what it's like to live in the shoes of a black man from a day-to-day basis in the United States. And so Opera Philadelphia, who I have an incredible relationship with, David Devan, was so eager to take on this project and make it a reality. And the debut happened a few years ago, but now we're going to record it for posterity and we'll be able to present this with Opera Philadelphia.
Yeah, even more relevant today.
It is. You know, it was written 3 or 4 years ago, but it is relevant today. It's no different than 1960. And I'm sure that, you know, because of the nature of things, it'll probably be relevant in 5 years from now. So I'm happy to be able to present this again, because I think it is very, very meaningful and timely.
Yeah. From a global perspective, Lawrence, is opera in general welcoming to black artists in 2020?
From a global perspective, you know, we can't go back and change history. And I think, you know, many of my colleagues, African-American people, now are getting the opportunities to be able to sing the lead roles on many of the important stages. And many of us have done this already. But I think there is room for more of us. And, you know, I think the thing that really will make the difference is when you begin to see organizations begin to diversify their boards and their administration, because the people that will be doing the hiring will be aware of the fact or the lack of black faces that are on their stages. And every now and again, once in a season, I don't think is enough. And so hopefully those things will begin to change. And thankfully, you know, Opera Philadelphia has a long history of colorblind casting. And if you look over the seasons, they've been one of the companies that have really led the charge. And so one of the big passions of mine is to try in other companies that I have some relationship with is to try to also increase that diversity, but also spilling into the audiences as well. So globally, I think it is changing, but I am definitely one of the people that's trying to push every day to make sure that is even more visible and more meaningful for us.
WHYY's Peter Crimmins first reported for us on the Opera Philadelphia Channel story a week or so ago. And David Devan, you told Peter, quote, the artistry that's going to be explored on this channel is different in its delivery than the artistry you're going to see on stage. Let's talk about artistry. How does this change?
Well, you know, one of the things we have done filming in the past, we have a film project that's we captured about a year and a half ago and is just waiting to get through some hoops for release. And one of the things that we noticed there is that the intimacy of performance for film is much greater than it is on stage. And so there's a level of patina and individualized care that the artist can explore in an intimate way that they can't on stage, and they can explore it multiple times through takes. And so there's like a refinement and an intimacy to the actual artistic expression. And we really want to tap into that and make sure that we're giving the artist that license. Cycles of My Being is a great case. Larry sang it a number of years ago in our Perlman Theater. One performance, 600 people got to see it. But now when he comes back to it with the cameras, there's opportunities. He can stop. He can think. He can work more intimately with the performers, the instrumentalists, to convey what he wants to convey and bring about maybe even more of his humanity in that moment. That's what we're trying to do. And the book part is hopefully thousands will see it, and which would be more as well. But that's the artistry we're hoping to get to.
And Larry, on a personal note for you, what changes for you when you were singing and acting for the camera as opposed to being on stage? How do you?
Well, the thing I try to do always when I'm doing anything that's recording is try to feel it emotionally and be tapped in and not necessarily acknowledge that the camera is there. When I can have a meaningful and expressive performance or something where I'm really, really tapped in, I think the audience or the listener can really see in to the desire for me to be an expressive, communicative artist. So I try as much as I can to ignore the camera and just try to even think about the text more and try to connect with some of my colleagues on stage or whatever it is to just make sure that it's not just panning for the camera, but having a meaningful time trying to be an expressive artist.
Is it more of a challenge? I would imagine being on stage, one take, there's the electricity from the live audience, which is hanging on to every note.
Ha-ha. Yes. You know, but there's something about live theater that, you know, David and I talk about it all the time, that we are both hopeful that when this pandemic is over, that people will be flocking to the theaters because nothing replaces live music. And this will just whet the appetite. So, yes, in the moment when you're on stage creating, there's something about live music that it doesn't have to be perfect, but it should be meaningful. And so you get one chance. But in this, you know, I think you have to have the same commitment, the same drive, the same desire to be expressive. And I hope that will read beyond the camera lenses, that people will know that we are trying to hold up a really, really highly, really high artistic level.
David, the pandemic, of course, has been an enormous threat across the board to the arts. Were there moments when you wondered whether Opera Philadelphia would survive this?
Yeah, in the early period of the pandemic and the lockdown, we were very afraid. We didn't know how long it was going to be and how we might get to the other side to it. And as we worked through what was then the end of our fiscal year and came to grips with moving the Butterfly, we did qualify for the PPP, forgivable loan, and our supporters really gathered and indicated they wanted to continue to support us. And those two things coming together allowed us to move from fear-based management, which we were deeply involved in, to a planning type of management and to think about how can we uplift art in this new reality. We did go from that scary place to the thoughtful place we are now.
Well, that's so nice to hear on your behalf. As you mentioned earlier, David, the new Opera Philadelphia channel is a subscription portal. Will this, do you think, bring in sufficient funds to keep the budget in good shape? Or are you still, you know, largely dependent on donors who have been faithful to the company?
largely dependent on donors who are faithful to the company and anybody new who wants to join in the family. You know, opera, by its very nature, can't help it. Opera, by its very nature, requires high degrees of philanthropy. And no one's ever really kind of done this before in terms, we don't know how many people are going to subscribe. You know, we started selling the minute we announced it, and we continue to sell. My hope is that we can get to enough numbers of people subscribing, that out of this beta test, it might actually be something that we maintain alongside our in real life performances. And there might be a way for Opera Philadelphia's artistic experience to reach thousands and thousands of more people than it might otherwise. And as Larry says, it's an encouragement and an enticement to come see us in real life as well. And so for us, from an economics, we're sort of dealing with this year is almost like a beta test for an ongoing channel that would become part of our regular life.
Okay, so 5 years down the road, what might this channel offer? How do you see it?
You know, it might be a little bit like Sundance. You know, Sundance has a festival, and we have a festival, and it's one thing, but then they have the Sundance Channel, and it's a different thing, but it's a celebration of independent film. So in 5 years from now, wouldn't it be great if we would continue to attract the best artists to our stages to do the most interesting work that they have in that season, and that there might be film people and people from outside opera that want to also work artistically in their mediums on this channel. For me, that would be a home run.
And again, remind us of the performances that had to be scrapped from the schedule this year because of the pandemic. And do you expect, David, to launch those productions sometime in the near future?
Yes, we've moved them. So there were three main programs from the planned for fall festival that had to be moved. So both Verdi's Macbeth has been moved to our festival in 23. The world premiere of Woman with Eyes Closed by our own Philadelphia's Jennifer Higdon, Pulitzer Prize winning composer, will be moved to next fall in the hopes that we will be back at it then. And then El Cimarron, which was supposed to be at the Barnes, is actually part of our digital channel, and we're reimagining that piece for the digital screen.
Okay, we've got a couple moments here for some comments. Yvonne says, my husband and I have been going to Opera Philadelphia since our 20s. We're now in our 50s. We love the company. We're so excited to view the Opera Channel. Would it be possible to have the ability to share a performance with a non-opera lover to show them what they're missing?
Wow. I'm putting that one down on the things to do list.
So stay tuned, in other words.
Okay. No, but it's a great idea. We've been talking about how do you do trial, and this is a great suggestion.
Okay. Larry, one more quick question for you. Dream roles for you down the road. What is something you've been really longing to do?
Oh, my gosh. I've been longing to do the role of Rodrigo in Rossini's Otello. I've done many, probably 16 or 17 Rossini roles to this date. And so that's one of the ones I would like to do. Also, Edgardo and Lucia is one of the things I've been looking at. And there are a couple other things that I hope to do going further into Donizetti. But yeah, I have many things that I still hope to do.
All right, we're about out of time. Lawrence Brownlee, tenor, artistic advisor at Opera Philadelphia. Thank you so much. Also, Opera Philadelphia president, David DeVan. It was a pleasure. Thanks for for joining us here on the Regional Roundup.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. John Ahrens produces the show. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thank you so much for joining us. Be well.